An investor recently said, "This is the best real estate market I've ever seen." At Sperry Van Mess Lilly & Associates, we've seen tough markets in the past and know you can benefit from them. We don't see tough, we see opportunity. We know the quickest way for buyers to achieve wealth is created in a buyer's market, and this is the best market we've seen for buyers in decades. We'll help you select, analyze, finance solid real estate investments. That's why Sperry Van Mess brokers are known as real estate advisors. Call Sperry Van Mess Lilly & Associates for a professional discussion about your investment goals. We'll locate properties we believe best fit you, then you decide if you agree. Call 800-345-6694. That's 800-345-6694. Visit our website, svmlillie.com. As a 17-year-old rookie in 1936, Bob Feller struck out 8 players against the St. Louis Cardinals in just 3 innings. In his first start, he struck out 15 players. And before he was out of his teens, he struck out 18 Tigers in one game. And Bob Feller pitched a no-hitter on his opening day in 1940. He earned the nicknames of Rapid Robert and Bullet Bob. And then December 7th, 1941 came, and Bob Feller volunteered to be in the Navy. Bob Feller, welcome to Veterans Radio. You were on the, you volunteered for the Navy, is that right, Mr. Feller?
I volunteered a couple of days after Pearl Harbor, and I signed up on the 9th of December and went to War College after boot camp. I was assigned to the battleship Alabama.
That was the
which was completed in the Navy Yard in the Portsmouth, Virginia, and sailed out of Hampton Roads. That was our home base. We spent 11 months taking supplies to Russia, and then we went out into the Pacific and spent almost 2 years out there getting General MacArthur back to the Philippines and on to Okinawa. And then I returned, of course, and played ball for another 10 years with the Cleveland Indians.
And you missed probably the four years that were in 1941, you won 25 games, and in 1946, 26 games in between, other than a short span in 1945. You were in the military. You ever regret enlisting?
No, I never had any regrets. We won World War II. It was an all-out war. It was a war we had to win and to protect the sovereignty of the United States of America. I didn't regret it at all. I thought I made a very good decision when I decided to join the Navy. I went to Chicago the day of Pearl Harbor to meet the general manager of the Cleveland Indians to sign my contract for the next year. I told him that night, on December 7th, I was going to join the Navy. And Gene Tunney, the head of the Navy Physical Fitness Program, flew out from Washington on Monday and swore me in Tuesday morning at the recruiting office in Chicago. And I went right from there to Norfolk for boot camp, and then on to the War College in Newport, Rhode Island, and back to the Alabama. And I had several weeks between the college at the War College and the Alabama sailing for Europe. And so I played ball with Norfolk Naval Training Station there for a few weeks before we took off for our convoy duty, taking supplies from Murmansk and Archangel for 11 months, and I played ball in the South Pacific, too, on some of the islands in the Pacific, where the CBs had made ball diamonds out there on some of the islands, and we had ball games. We played under the other ships, and I played catch-aboard ship quite a bit, besides giving exercises every day to, when the condition permitted, to the crew aboard the Alabama. That was my job, to give exercises twice a day. One half the ship at one time and half the other ship another time to keep the officers and the crew in shape. And sometimes we did it and sometimes we couldn't, depending on what the situation was at the moment.
I imagine north of the Arctic Circle it was a little difficult to play catch.
Speak up.
I said, I imagine north of the Arctic Circle it was a little difficult to play baseball, play catch
well,
on the ship.
We were in Iceland in the summer one time. We played a softball game in Reykjavik, there at the Navy base in Reykjavik, and I didn't play baseball in Iceland, but we did play softball a couple of times, and in the middle of the, in the summertime when the sun was up, the sun never went down, and it was daylight all the time when we were playing up there. And we didn't do that only two or three times, and we went to we didn't stop there that often.
It was surprising to me to learn that the Alabama was assigned to the British Home Fleet for some period of time at the beginning of the war.
Well, we were there with this battleship South Dakota, and one of our carriers, a Ranger, was with us, and we had a few destroyers and other ships, capital ships, the cruisers, heavy and light. Quite a British kind of carrier there, the Illustrious, and also the heavy cruiser, the Rodney, was with us, and we had other escorts, but we did have take Liberty ships full of supplies to Murmansk and Archangel during the winter of 43-44, and it was very, very cold, and then we headed for the 42-43, I should say. Then we headed to the Pacific and spent about not quite 2 years out there before I came back, and was a manager of the Great Lakes team at Great Lakes, Illinois, where we had a very fine Major League ball club and playing games against all the Major League clubs and a lot of other clubs and Air Force bases and other professional teams and amateur teams for the entertainment of the personnel. They had 110,000 sailors at the lakes then, Great Lakes going in training.
That's where I took my basic training was Great Lakes. I was a CB myself. And one of my uncles was a Navy gunner on one of those Liberty ships.
Those Liberty ships had the armed guard aboard on it. Had a small gun on the bow. They didn't have a whole lot to protect themselves with. We were supposed to protect them all. I only ever saw one of them get sunk, and we rescued everybody who was on that.
Oh, really?
On that particular ship, it got hit with a torpedo.
That was up in the North Sea, was it?
Man, in that particular instance, thank heavens.
Was that up in the North Sea? On the Murmansk
in the North Atlantic, yes, it was up somewhere off the south of Iceland, a little bit southeast of Iceland, where it happened. We got everybody off before they had to hit the water.
I'm sure they were pleased with that. That water is cold up there.
We played ball in New Hebrides. We played in the Fiji Islands, and the Seabees, of course. The Seabees got started down there and near Ocean View at Little Creek, Virginia, where they started, had the first CB base. Then they opened up a couple more for training purposes. One of them was on the West Coast, and another one, I think, was in Bainbridge, Maryland. But the CBs did a tremendous job in the Pacific. I didn't know anything about what they did in the Atlantic. They did a tremendous job in the Pacific and all those islands, going in and securing them and helping build up the bases that we needed for staging bases to win that war out in the Pacific. The Seabees certainly were a very big part of winning that war.
Well, they set quite a standard for us guys that came along later to follow. Just one last question about that North Sea. Now, you were on the Murmansk run. That weather is terrible up there. What was your job on the Alabama?
Well, I was a gun captain. I was on the anti-aircraft guns. And we were on the main deck, on the port side, on the main deck, about three-fourths of the way back to the third turret, just near the third turret, on a fantail. And it was cold, it was windy, and it was wet. And it was pretty tough duty. We were standing four-hour watches, 4 hours at a time, with about 25 men on the guns. And on the 40-millimeter quads, which I was on.
Okay.
Sometimes we had to secure the gun if the weather was really too tough. You couldn't, the waves were too high. It was too wet and too cold and too much ice. But the destroyers, of course, it was tough for the destroyers because they had to chip ice all the time. The battleship didn't have to chip the ice. And we did have aircraft cover, of course. And then the new German planes would come out every now and then, take a look and see where we were, what we were doing. Of course, you take a shot at them and hit one once in a while, but not too often. But after we finished, got rid of the Von Tirpitz, the battleship Tirpitz, we call it the Tirpitz. It was hiding in a fjord in Norway, north of Trondheim, and the British helped sink it with their bombers. We shelled it and torpedoed it, and that was the last ship the Germans had. Then we went to the Pacific. But it was 11 months taking supplies to Murmansk and Archangel, and through the ice, and we had icebreakers and so forth. For the big Russian icebreakers took us right into the ports. But then the Pacific was all the across the equator 28 times in 1944. In our natural operations, trying to catch the Jap fleet and win back the Pacific.
The Japanese had quite a fleet, too. In fact, theirs was a bit larger than ours, wasn't it, at one point?
I didn't get that.
I said the Japanese fleet was a bit larger than ours at one point, wasn't it?
Well, the new battleships, the ships that were hit at Pearl Harbor, on the attack on Pearl Harbor, the battleships, they were World War One vessels. They were not as good as the Japanese battleships. But the new battleships, like the Alabama and the Wisconsin and New Jersey and the Missouri and the Iowa and then South Dakota and Massachusetts, the Indiana and the North Carolina, our new battleships are better than the Japanese, and that's why we won the war. We had very good cooperation and very good teamwork, too, from all the sailors. And a great admiral out there in the Pacific, too, was Admiral Nimitz, who was based in Honolulu. We had Admiral Michener. We had good captains aboard our ships. We had great teamwork, and teamwork won that war.
And you, your ship was looking, your task force was always looking for the Japanese. Now, you never saw them in a surface battle, but you had quite a few encounters being attacked by air. Is that not right?
Well, we had air attacks, and we were involved in that Mariana, what they call the Mariana Turkey Shoot off of Saipan in the Philippine Sea. We shot 474, I believe, Japanese aircraft down one day. Our fighters got a lot of them, and our aircraft batteries got them. So that was what they call the Mariana's Turkey Shoot, and that was the end of the Japanese Naval Air Force. We sunk a couple of their carriers, maybe three of them, and other warships, cruisers, et cetera. I don't think we sunk any battleships. We might have damaged a couple of them. But that was what they call it, referred to in the Navy as the Mariana's Turkey Shoot, and that was the end of the Japanese Naval Air Force.
I think you sunk.
That ship went down that day. It was in June 1944.
I think you sunk three carriers and damaged the fourth one.
Well, we did a lot of damage, and that was the end of the Japanese Naval Air Force. And they knew then. They knew when the sun went down that night, their officers knew that the naval war was over and they had lost.
Let me ask you this. When you're under air attack like that, you've got every gun firing, I imagine, at least on that side of the ship. What was the noise like and what was the feeling like? Or were you just too busy to have feelings at that moment?
Well, that's about it. You're just too busy. There's a lot of noise, of course, and a lot of firing and a lot of smoke and a lot of tracer bullets flying around. And you always think that none of those bullets have got your name on it. It's got the other guy's name on it. Of course, you know in your own heart you might find one that has your name on it. If one has your name on it, you're a hero. If it doesn't have, you're a survivor. That's the way it is.
You just described it quite well. On the way over to Vietnam, I was looking at the rest of my squad, and I thought, gee, I wonder if any of these guys are going to get it. Thought never occurred that it might be me. But I want to go back to baseball just a moment. When you signed, you were 16 years old. Gordie Howe, the great hockey player for Detroit, signed for a team jacket. You got a dollar and an autographed baseball. You were 16. You could have broken that contract the next year.
And well, I still have the original contract written on a piece of stationery from a hotel in Des Moines, Iowa. I'm from near Des Moines, Van Meter, which is 15 miles west of Des Moines. And I got a dollar and an autographed ball by the Cleveland Indians and signed with Cy Slapnick. He also signed three players like Lou Boudreau and Mel Harder and Trotsky and Herb Score. And
great names.
Most all the Cleveland players. He became general manager. And he was a man I was seeing in Chicago on the night of December 7th to sign my 42 contract. I told him I was going to join the Navy. He said, congratulations. I'm going to go back to Cleveland, resign. I'm tired of being general manager. He's there 6 years. I'm going to go back to scouting in Cedar Rapids. So Cy Slapnick did that and went back to scouting in Cedar Rapids.
It was a different era then, and people had different values.
Well, now, the values were completely different. We had a lot better leadership than we have today. In fact, we don't have any leadership today that I care for at all.
We could spend a lot of time talking about that.
Except Bob, the head of the Pentagon now, Bob Gates, he's a very good leader, but he's about the only one I know of in Washington at the moment that I trust.
Had you broken that contract, you could have gotten, according to some sources,
$100,000. Well, I signed illegally, like most, a lot of players are signed that way. Right. And those minor league teams had territorial rights to sign all the free agents in their area, but all the major league scouts were cheating and they'd using false names and et cetera to sign the players. I was managed to stay with the Cleveland Ball Club. They changed that rule a few weeks later in the winter of 1937 at the major league meetings. There are no more territorial rights for minor league ball clubs to sign players and sell them to the big league clubs who finance them.
And you never looked back after you got the dollar when you some sources said you could have got $100,000 the next year.
Well, that was the American way of doing things. It was opportunity.
Yep.
I had the opportunity to make good, which luckily I was able to do. Had a lot of help, of course, from Cy Slapnick and my parents and the coaches and the teammates. I was lucky enough to have a good career, and I'm very happy today being here in Arizona with the Cleveland Baseball Club, working out in the beautiful complex here in Goodyear, Arizona, right near Phoenix.
I understand you threw out the first pitch for their new ballpark.
I was one of the first pitchers. A couple other people threw, and the mayor and one of the sponsors threw out the first pitch. I threw out the last first pitch in uniform, of course, the Cleveland Indian uniform. That's it's a big honor, and I do appreciate it. And they're doing a good job for us here in Goodyear, and we're drawing quite well. And we got a state-of-the-art facility. I'll be here till April 1st with my wife, Ann, to go back to Cleveland after April 1st when spring training closes up.
We're coming up on the first break, Bob, and I just want to mention one thing before we come up on the break. Your dad is the guy that got you pitching, tossing the ball back and forth, and he built a ball diamond that with the stands.
Well, my father built a ball diamond on the farm in Iowa, the Oakview team. We were there 4 years. Of course, I played 4 years of American Legion ball. I played a lot of semi-pro high school, summer vacation Bible school. I was playing ball ever since I was 9 years old.
Okay, real good. Well, we're coming on the break, and we'll be right back right after this, and you are listening to Veterans Radio.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them. Captain Edward Allworth led his men across the river by swimming it. Details after this.
It's pouring rain. It's real dark outside. Your heart starts beating really fast. You've never done anything so hard in your life. This is boot camp. This is the real thing now. It's such extreme pain, you don't understand how you can finish. It takes special inner strength, courage, and desire to become a Marine. And when I finished, I was like, I'm done. I did it. The moment I will never forget is when this drill instructor that I admire so much comes up to me straight in front of me, put her arm on my shoulder and said, "Good morning, Marine."
PFC Summer Volkman became a United States Marine. Can you? Call 1-800-MARINES.
While his company was crossing a French river and canal at a bridgehead during World War I, the bridge was destroyed by shell fire. It Allworth's command became separated, part of it being on the east bank of the canal and the remainder on the west bank. Seeing his advanced units making slow headway up the steep slope ahead, he mounted the canal bank and called for his men to follow. Plunging in, he swam across the canal under fire from the enemy, followed by his men. Inspiring his men, he led them up the slope, joining his hard-pressed platoons in front. By his personal leadership, he forced the enemy back for more than a kilometer, overcoming machine gun nest and capturing 100 prisoners, whose number exceeded that of the men in his command. The exceptional courage and leadership displayed by Allworth made possible the reestablishment of a bridgehead over the canal and the successful advance of other troops. The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.